Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Pinterest, they're all taking over politics these days. It's nothing exactly new, but online campaigning still is a new frontier for politics. Joining us now to continue our social media and politics conversation is Alex Fitzpatrick. He's a reporter at social media blog site Mashable's New York headquarters, where he covers the intersection of politics, international affairs, social media, and technology. Welcome back, Alex.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me again.
The organization Rock the Vote, we've been hearing about it for, 20 years now, but now they want to register 1.5 million voters before the November election now. And their tactic, of course, is somehow have something to do with social media. Tell us what they're doing.
Absolutely. The social media angle to their campaign is a Twitter campaign called hashtag scan to vote. And the scan refers to a T-shirt they're going to be selling at Whole Foods stores nationwide that have what's called a QR code. QR stands for quick response. You've seen them on advertisements on subways and buses and things like that all over the place. They're the little black and white things that look sort of like a barcode, but a little bit different, a square, squiggly lines. Mm-hmm. You scan these things with your phone, and it automatically takes you to some relevant website or, you know, other thing online. And the idea here is that these T-shirts, you scan them with your phone, and they take you automatically to a website where you can register to vote online. Only about 10 states have methods to vote online. So if you're outside of one of those states, what it does is through a neat little thing on the back end, it'll take your data that you plug in and it'll automatically fill out the appropriate voter registration form for your state. It'll email it to you, and then you print it out, fill out the rest of it, sign it, and send it to the relevant office to register. And the idea is if you're wearing the shirt, you effectively become almost a mobile hotspot for voter registration. Anybody with a smartphone can come up and say, oh, I want to, you know, register to vote. They can scan it and take care of it right there on the spot.
And it's being promoted through Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, the hashtag on Twitter is hashtag scan to vote. They have a Facebook campaign as well. And that's really all about reaching out. I mean, Rock the Vote is entirely, their mission is to get youth voters on board. Speaking with the president of it, and, you know, she says, she agreed with me that compared to 2008, a lot of the youth vote is very much disengaged or disillusioned from, you know, they're not as excited about this election as they were 4 years ago. So their mission is to get them excited about it and get them voting.
And social media is always a way to do that, to just get involved.
Yeah, because they're you know, youth are so very active on a plethora of social media, so it makes a lot of sense to be targeting them there, trying to reach out to the platforms where they're familiar that they're familiar with, and so many of them have smartphones and are familiar with that, with QR codes and those kind of things. So it makes a lot of sense to target a youth voting campaign digitally.
My guest is Alex Fitzpatrick, a reporter with Mashable. If you have a question or comment about social media and politics, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. You can tweet us at AnnFisherWOSU. So Pinterest has become an increasingly popular social networking tool. Michelle Obama and others have recently joined. Of course, you know, she could join anytime she wants, but what advantages, you know, does Pinterest have that other sites like Twitter or Facebook don't?
Sure, yeah. Pinterest is entirely a visual network. It's all about imagery. It's all about showing something through imagery. I think that's why a lot of journalists have adopted it. But then a lot of political campaigns are realizing, you know, hey, we can tell the story of our campaign visually as well. And it makes a lot of sense to do that on Pinterest because it is such an image-rich site. So pictures of, say, the Obama family hanging out behind the scenes paints a scene of Obama as a family man that might appeal to some voters. And so that's sort of where the campaign is using Michelle Obama's Pinterest. And it really is run by the campaign. She did approve the copy on a lot of the captions for the photos, but you know, her Pinterest page is run by the campaign.
You know, one thing about Pinterest, they found that it doesn't do as well if you're trying to constantly sell something on it.
Yeah, and I think that goes with a lot of social media. The key, if you're running a campaign on social media and you're just selling something, and that's all your tweets, your Facebook posts and your Pinterest posts are about, people are going to tire of that really quickly. The idea is, and this is just good social media practice in general, if you're doing some sort of marketing, if you're selling something, whether it's a product or a nonprofit organization or a political campaign, the best thing you can do is tweet interesting stories and post, you know, more human interest stuff, things that engage people on an emotional level, and then sneak in, you know, the sale once in a while on the side there.
And also a sense that they feel like they're really connecting with you, that it's really you there.
Yeah,
it's really
exactly.
You, it's really your little kitchen widget that you really do like.
Right, and that's something... Yeah, and that's something that a lot of political campaigns struggle with. If you look at Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, for instance, their Twitter accounts often aren't, you know, them themselves tweeting out messages. I don't know if Mitt Romney does this. I don't think he does. But with Barack, he will, if he's actually behind the message, he's actually the one writing it and approving it, it'll say, it'll have a little signature, B.O., at the end of it. So you know this is a tweet from the president himself. And that's how, you know, on Pinterest, on Michelle Obama's Pinterest page, that she approved the caption that says MO. But then if you look at the lower levels of politics, you know, you get into Congress, state level stuff, and then especially the local level, a lot of many more politicians at those levels are actually tweeting. Cory Booker, mayor of Newark, is famous for his nonstop tweeting. Senator Ron Wyden is big, often tweeting. Senator Grassley is tweets a lot, much to comedian Stephen Colbert's approval. You know, he tweets just a sort of not really in the full English language, so it's easy to pick fun at them.
Yeah, you actually gave me an idea. Maybe next time we'll go over some Colbert musings when it comes to the tweeters. Kendall in Columbus, you're on the air. You want to go back a little bit to that Rock the Vote?
Yeah, hi, Andy.
Hi.
What?
Yep.
I just kind of, in my mind, I'm not sure the logistics and the numbers in regards to the QR code and unregistered voters, but it seems like a lot of people who have access to a smartphone can scan the QR code. It seems like they're not really going to be the people who are not registered. In my mind, it seems like a lot of people who aren't registered will not have a smartphone. So I'm just kind of wondering if the benefit of having a QR program is really going to outweigh targeting people who don't have smartphones.
So does the target demographic match the target technological necessity to do it? Alex?
It's a great question. It's something that I raise with the Rock the Vote people as well, because I agree that you know, there's definitely a huge demographic of voters that don't have, can't afford a smartphone, aren't using that device. So there are certainly people that this campaign will miss. But I think there are plenty of people that do have that technology that the campaign will succeed. And I think if you look at, you know, the demographics of it, and Rock the Vote's a nonpartisan organization, so they're not looking to – they just want people to vote. They're not looking to, say, vote for Romney, vote for Obama, vote left, vote right. But if you're looking at – if the Democrats are going to do something like this, you know, maybe this is a generalization – but, you know, maybe more, you know, less advantaged people, less financially well-off people are Democratic voters, say, for instance. So this maybe wouldn't make sense to target people like that with this campaign. But I'm sure that something else would be more appropriate.
Thank you very much.
All right, Kendall, thanks for the call. Let's turn to the, I guess, you know, the bottom line of politics, which is campaign fundraising. And you wrote last week about how you can now donate to political campaigns via text message. This is new. We've been able to do it, say, for Red Cross when, you know, there was the disaster in Haiti and any number of places you can do that now. But for campaigns and for political purposes, this is brand new, right?
Yeah, it's sort of brand new. Okay. The Obama campaign was doing this beforehand, but because of the FEC and because of cell carrier regulations, political campaigns couldn't previously get text message donations right from the text message, taken from a phone bill. But what the Obama campaign did, and this was pretty smart, in my opinion, was if you had already donated to the Obama campaign and your credit card information was on file, you donated on the website, then they would keep your cell phone number on file, and they would, you know, sometimes text out of this blast message that would say, hey, why don't you donate $5 to the Obama campaign right now? And if you replied yes or whatever it was, it would take that money from your credit card, not from your cell phone bill. But what this change made last week does is allows political campaigns to receive donations from people that are taken right off their phone bill. And as you said, you know, organizations like the Red Cross had been doing this with Haiti to a great success. They've gotten a lot of money through that. So this could be really an effective platform to get, you know, very small donations, $3, $5, by asking supporters, hey, why don't you send us a few dollars? Which, you know, when you multiply that many times over, that becomes a nice substantial little sum. And it also increases the small donation metric, and donations under $100, which both campaigns really like to say, you know, as a counter to the argument, you know, there's too much big money in politics. They say, well, look at how many people are sending us $5, $10. That's, you know, a nice metric for them.
And the FEC, they capped it, though, at $50 each.
Yes, it's okay. $50 each billing cycle for each campaign.
Okay.
So you can go off, if there's 100 political campaigns you want to donate $5 to, in one billing cycle, you can send them each $50. But you have to wait till the next cycle to do it again for another campaign.
Is this popular? I mean, are a lot of campaigns picking up on this now?
I haven't seen them, any of the campaigns do it yet.
Okay.
It hasn't hit my radar, but I assume that they'll start to do it, especially just because the Obama campaign had used it with a lot of success, the workaround I was talking about before. So I figure, you know, why not? Why wouldn't you use this mechanism? And something I just wrote about today that broke today, this new platform, it's not a new platform, but it's a platform for commerce over Twitter.
Uh-huh.
They're now, they've got 25 congressmen on board, congresspeople. And you can now donate to a campaign, a political campaign, right with just a tweet. Once you signed up for this site, it just you put your credit card information in the site, and the tweet gets picked up by the site, and it happens. All the transaction happens on the back end. You don't have to worry about it. The Romney and Obama campaigns haven't signed on yet, but the platform is really trying to pitch it and get them on board.
You know, the commercial interests have figured this out by now. The big ones that thought they could use social media just to advertise, and they found out that once you open a Facebook page for your new car or your new whatever you're trying to sell, you can get compliments, but you can also get criticism, and the campaigns are probably finding this out as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's especially apparent when a campaign uses a hashtag around some kind of campaign. The GOP right now is a really big fan of hashtag Obama economics and hashtag not doing fine. And they'll tweet out stories that show, you know, the economy is struggling, that kind of thing, with that hashtag. And then you can do a search on Twitter for that hashtag, and it shows you this whole conversation of people talking about, you know, how Obama's policies might be failing. But also, when a campaign uses those hashtags, it can sometimes be reversed by, you know, the campaign's opponents to make fun of that side or point holes in that side's argument and that kind of thing. So hashtag campaigns for political campaigns and for businesses, too, can really go awry very quickly.
Which is part of the fun.
Yeah.
Alex Fitzpatrick of Mashable, thanks for joining us again. You enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me, too.
It's Alex Fitzpatrick. He's a reporter with Mashable. He's in their New York headquarters. He covers the intersection of politics, international affairs, social media, and technology. Coming up, more on Apple. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Warfighting continues to evolve, and in many ways, the United States leads the way. Covert CIA operations, special forces, armed drones, and cyber warfare. Covert battles, strategies hashed out behind closed doors. I'm Neil Conan. David Sanger, author of the new book, Confront and Conceal, and NPR commentator Ted Koppel join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And if you contributed to our station this year, thank you. Our fiscal year ends on June 30th, and we still have about $50,000 to raise to meet our annual goal and to continue to provide you with the highest quality news and information. If you wish to make an additional gift or fulfill your current gift, you can do so right now at WOSU.org. Thanks for supporting 89.7 NPR News. 84 degrees in downtown Columbus, warm today, sunny skies, and a high of 92. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Microsoft Corporation yesterday unveiled the first computer it has ever made, a tablet called the Surface, and it's designed to stand up against the Apple iPad. Joining us now to talk about this new development and more is Macworld's executive editor, John Seff. He's been covering all things Apple for more than a decade. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi.
You know, when I say that it's the first computer Microsoft has ever made, it made one of my producers stop this morning, like, wait a minute, their first computer? And that's kind of hard to imagine that it's just their first.
Well, I mean, Microsoft is a software company. You know, they're all about Windows, and they've licensed that to all the partners and sell it individually. And their whole idea was you create the software, the operating system to run it on, and they don't care what the hardware is. They just provide the software.
So the new Microsoft tablet was touted as a vehicle for the forthcoming Windows 8. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. It was designed with, which was designed with the tablet in mind. And when I was looking at the, you know, the videos online of the device of the new Microsoft Surface, it started to make sense how they put the tiles together, and then they call it the Surface, and, you know, all the lexicon started to fall into place.
Yeah, and, you know, I think what Microsoft is doing is they're designing Windows 8 as a platform operating system. So it is for desktop computers. It is a mobile operating system for smartphones and also for tablets. And here Microsoft is actually releasing its own tablet running its own software. So it's really interesting.
One analyst said the combination of PC and tablet features makes Surface a true converged device. And they called it a Swiss Army knife of a tablet. And I was wondering if that really distinguishes it and if that might be what helps it compete against something like the iPad.
You know, it's a little bit hard to know right now what exactly Microsoft is going after with the product because there's so many things about it we still don't know. They announced basically two different versions of it. One is a sort of lower-end version running Windows RT, and one is a higher-end version running Windows 8 Pro. They have different specs, they have different hardware, they have different ports, and we also don't know when they're coming out exactly, and we don't know how much they're going to cost. So at this point, you know, it's really hard. The closest one, the first product, is probably not going to come out, they say, until when Windows 8 comes out this fall. So that's probably at least three more months, and then the Pro version is going to come out for 3 months after that. So the real flagship product that Microsoft is going to release here is not going to be available for at least 6 months. And I'm sure we'll get more information on specs between now and then. But right now, it's kind of hard to know exactly what the product is going to be and how it's going to compete.
And just from looking at it, then it's just hard to say whether or not it can compete with iPad. You have to know the price point right off the bat, but it would be hard to imagine they would price it much over iPad.
Well, you know, what they said was that the RT version is going to sell around the same price as other tablets running the ARM processor. Mm-hmm. And those range, I think, from about $300 to $700. And then the Windows 8 version is going to be priced around the Ultrabook line that's out there. And those, I think, are sort of in the $800 to $1,500 range, mm-hmm. $800 to $1,500 range. So, you know, there's a really wide berth there, and it's really hard to tell what they're going to price these at. You know, the iPad starts at $499 and goes up to, I think it's $829 now for the largest one with the 4G. And that's another thing we don't know is Microsoft didn't actually announce any cellular connections, 3G mm-hmm. or 4G data connections. So as far as we know right now, these are only Wi-Fi devices, which means that if you're not within a Wi-Fi network, then you have no internet connectivity. And they probably will have that, but they haven't announced that yet.
The Surface, maybe this is a gadget it's already popped up elsewhere, but it has a built-in kickstand and a magnetic cover that you can use as a touch keyboard. Now, I really like that idea.
Yeah, that's actually one of the really interesting things about this product. The built-in kickstand is great because a lot of times with a tablet, you want to have it propped up for reading or for typing or for anything you want to do with it. And you know, with the iPad, that's achieved via a cover, and, you know, there are lots of third-party covers and cases for it, and Apple has its own that you can use, but having this built in seems really nice. And then, as you mentioned, the keyboard, you know, the keyboard is part of that case, and it flips over, and then you have a keyboard with a, you know, multi-touch trackpad and everything built right in, which sounds really great. I'm not sure until people mm-hmm. actually try it, it's hard to say how it's going to feel and how it's going to work. You know, it's not going to be a solid keyboard with lots of transport when you press the keys down, but for what it's intended for, it might be nice, but it does look really interesting with that.
Well, let's turn our sights to Apple now. Once again, if you're just joining the show, my guest is Jonathan Seff. He's executive editor of Macworld, and Apple made a splash at their annual Worldwide Developers Conference, or WWDC, in San Jose last week. Among the announcements was a slew of new products and upgrades to existing Apple products, but I don't, as far as I can tell, none of them necessarily made the front page of USA Today.
Well, in terms of the products, Apple refreshed its entire laptop line.
Mm-hmm.
So there were new MacBook Airs, which is the very portable version of their laptop. There's the new MacBook Pros. But the one that actually made the headlines was the new, called the MacBook Pro with Retina display. And Retina display is something that first came out with the iPhone 4, and then also with the third-generation iPad, the new iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind that is that the pixel density is so great on the screen that at a normal viewing distance, the human eye shouldn't be able to distinguish the individual pixels. And it's a term that Apple made up, but it basically means that the screen is really, really high resolution with a very high pixel density. And this MacBook Pro with Retina display is the first one to have what, you know, Apple is calling the Retina display on a non iOS device, on an actual laptop, and so it's got that new screen. But they completely redesigned the inside and did lots of really exciting engineering to get a very thin, light product that's actually of the pro level in terms of performance and speed.
If anyone has a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. So aside from that, is it called Retina display?
Yes, the Retina display.
How does the new model stand apart from the current line of MacBook Pros then?
Well, they added a bunch of things to it. The display is the biggest thing, and it's, 5 million pixels on it. It's a very high-resolution screen. There's also no glass cover on it because of the new design, and that makes for less reflection and glare, which is something people have complained about with the laptops for a while because there's glass that covers it,
mm-hmm.
and so there's a lot of glare and reflection, so people have complained about that. There's a newer generation of Intel processors, the Ivy Bridge processors, and things like the latest technologies like Thunderbolt and USB 3.0. And at the same time, to get something that's really this light and thin, there are some compromises. There's no optical drive, so no DVD drive. You can't watch DVDs or burn them. There's also no Ethernet port for networking or FireWire port, which is one of Apple's high-speed networking connections. And so those things you all need to use with an external device. But part of that is that, having a display this large and powerful with so many pixels requires a lot of battery. So Apple had to do a lot of engineering to have custom large battery inside, and they have custom memory and custom RAM. So it's an interesting product. It's a pro product, but it's not as upgradable as other pro products have been in the past because of the engineering that goes into making it this lightweight, portable pro system.
Yeah, it's been criticized to some extent for making them thinner and less upgradable, as you just mentioned, and repairable. To what extent is that a caution for people who might want to buy this and check it out?
I think that for the third-party repair community especially, it's a big deal. But I think advances in engineering like this require some radical changes and often some compromises.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a pro customer that wants the best portable system from Apple, you'll pay to upgrade it directly from Apple because that's the only way to do it. If you want to have the full 16 gigabytes of RAM, you have to do that when you order it because that's directly on the motherboard. You can't do that later. So it's something to consider when you're buying it. You want to look at and see, what am I going to use this for and how much money you want to spend up front. But if it's meant for a pro audience, then spending a little bit more up front to get something that's going to be longer lasting and more powerful makes a lot of sense. But, it's too early to tell whether the repairability thing is going to come into play and how much of an issue that's going to be.
There was an article on Macworld about how Apple's new laptop redefines the concept of a pro laptop. I was wondering, how does this laptop shed any light on Apple's future plans or philosophy for how they want consumers to work with their laptops?
Well, for the last several years, every quarter, if you look at Apple's sales numbers, the majority of Macs sold have been laptops, have been portables. And that trend has been going on, as mentioned, for several years. And because of the power that people are able to get out of a laptop and the portability, it's become, you know, Apple's top-selling product, having those laptops. So I think that what you're seeing is Apple is putting a lot of engineering work into making the products that most people want into more powerful for roughly the same amount of money. This new MacBook Pro costs more than the other ones, but Apple has not gotten rid of the other MacBook Pros. There's still the 13-inch and 15-inch MacBook Pro non-Retina display. So for now, Apple's keeping several tiers. There's the MacBook Air, which is very inexpensive and very portable, the regular MacBook Pro, and then the 15-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display. And it's possible that Apple will have a 13-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display, you know, in the coming months as well, and then that'll round out that top part of the line. And Apple also discontinued the 17-inch MacBook Pro, which was the most powerful, largest screen, largest resolution model that was out there. And I think that shows that people want the power, but they still want the portability, and that 15-inch is really the sweet spot. But having that broad line going from the MacBook Air up to the MacBook Pro with Retina display shows Apple's sort of philosophy on portables, which is every possibility that you can have without being overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. For that, for all of that, what are we talking about in terms of cost?
Well, the MacBook Pro, the Retina display model, begins at, I believe it's $2,199. So $2,200 is the Retina display, and you can go up from there with faster processors, with more memory, more RAM, but it starts at $2,199. And with the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro, it's a much lower price point. The MacBook Pro begins at $1,199. So fairly good entry-level price, and the MacBook Air start at $999. So there's a very wide spectrum there of how much you can spend, depending on your needs.
Do you think that higher cost, that $2,199, is going to be worth it, or is there enough of a market there for something at that level?
I think that there is, and I think that if you wanted to try to go and order one of those online right now, there may be a little bit of a wait. Hmm. Apple's actually showing 3 to 4 weeks shipping for the Retina display MacBook Pro, whereas the other MacBook Pros are all available now and in stock. So people seem to have flocked to it, and the price difference, if you're a professional and you're using it for professional photography, and, you know, for someone like a photographer, that really high pixel density and really great quality screen lets you zoom in on your images, see really fine details. And they mentioned during the keynote that it's such high resolution that you could be editing video in Final Cut Pro, for example, and see the entire video of a 1080p video in one corner of the screen at full resolution and still have the rest of the interface to work with. So for a pro customer, I don't really think that price is an issue, and the backlog kind of bears that out right now.
Apple announced their new laptops in conjunction with a new computer operating system, OS 10.9, or Mountain Lion. What's that about?
It's 10.8, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was written 10.9.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that'll be next year.
Okay.
10.8 is Mountain Lion, and it's the successor to Lion. And as the name suggests, it's sort of building on Lion. Apple's been using this big cat metaphor since OS X came out. There's been Cheetah, Puma, Jaguar, you know, all these different big cats. And Mountain Lion is actually coming out next month. It's coming out in July. Apple hasn't said exactly when yet. And it's only going to be $20 to upgrade to the latest OS if you're running the past two versions. So if you're running 10.7, which is Lion, or 10.6, which is Snow Leopard. It brings a lot of good features to the Mac OS. And a lot of them are things that are coming from the iOS devices, so things that have been in the iPhone and the iPad are actually coming to the desktop version, things like dictation. So you can actually speak system-wide dictation where you can speak to your computer and have it take down what you're saying. Things like Game Center, which is the iOS gaming hub that's built into the iOS devices, is coming to the Mac. Something called AirPlay Mirroring, which lets you send the contents of your Mac screen to your TV through one of Apple's Apple TV set-top boxes. You can do that now with an iPad or an iPhone. Now you'll be able to do that with your Mac as well. And some other things, improvements to Safari, Apple's web browser. Mm-hmm. And these are things that are going across the iOS and the Mac platform. So a lot of stuff where they're actually trying to bridge the gap and bring some of the features from one to the other and have a lot more interoperability, because a lot of people are coming to the Mac from being iOS customers. A lot of people buy an iPhone or an iPad and they're PC users, and they see the Apple way of doing things and they like it and they decide to become a Mac user. So I think in a lot of ways making the Mac OS work a lot like the mobile operating system makes a lot of sense from Apple's point of view.
What about another... Apple also announced their new laptops. Well, I want to talk about the iOS 6, the latest mobile operating system. What's new
right.
about that?
iOS 6, that's coming out in the fall. Apple hasn't specified exactly when, but the previous one came out October 12th of last year, so September, October timeframe. And there's some big features in there, and some of them are actually similar to what's in the desktop operating system. System-wide integration with Twitter has already been there. There's going to be Facebook integration. There's a new Do Not Disturb feature that you can turn on, and it will keep the rings and buzzes from happening on your phone or your device at night, so you don't get an alert when you get a new tweet in the middle of the night. But you can also configure it so that if someone's on your favorites list, their call will still come through, or if someone calls multiple times in case there's some kind of emergency, that'll come through. They've actually replaced Google Maps in the next version of the operating system. Mm-hmm. And it's a new, completely new map feature, and there's turn-by-turn driving directions, which has been in other platforms and other types of phones before, but not on the iPhone. You've had to have a third-party app to get that. So Apple's adding its own turn-by-turn driving directions, and they did this really interesting 3D flyover feature, where they had helicopters and airplanes flying over cities and taking detailed photos, and they turn these into these graphics so you can load them on your phone or your iPad, and you can circle around them and zoom in and see things from a really detailed perspective. Siri, which is Apple's voice recognition system where you speak to it and then it answers you. They've done some improvements there. There's sports and movie queries, so you can say, who won the football game today, and it'll answer you, or what's the latest movie starring Angelina Jolie, and it'll answer you that. So there's a lot of integration there, a lot of stuff there, and also a new app called Passbook. And the idea is it's for retailers and ticket vendors and airlines to give you electronic tickets, and this collects them all into one. So you could collect your Fandango movie tickets and your United Airline e-ticket and all that stuff into one app, or even your Starbucks credit. So you just have one app and you launch it, and it has all of your passes, as they call them. And there's a lot of other stuff that they're working on for this too. There's a lot of information on macworld.com, and there's a lot of information on Apple's website, too, about this. Everything that we know and that we're allowed to talk about based on what Apple's announced. We've been looking in-depth on a lot of these things, and we're looking a lot more in-depth every day.
Okay.
So there's a lot of new information coming out.
That is why we do this every Tuesday, just to barely keep up. We just claw our way through the information.
One week in the tech industry is an eternity.
I know it. It just cracks me up too. Jonathan Seff, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Of course, thank you.
Jonathan Seff, he is executive editor at Macworld. Coming up, Mike Gikas, he's senior editor for Consumer Reports. We're going to talk about the new Verizon data-only billing plan. promises to overhaul the way Verizon and possibly the rest of the wireless industry handles service payments. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Former Major League pitcher Bob Ojeda writes that he's lived with pain in his left arm since he was 12 and started pitching in Little League. On the next Fresh Air, Ojeda talks about the glory and pain of pitching. Also, part two of our interview with Sandra Katz about fermenting foods and beverages. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to join us tomorrow for All Sides with Ann Fisher. At 10 o'clock, a discussion of the Jerry Sandusky trial and issues of justice and healing for survivors of childhood sexual abuse. And then in the second hour of All Sides tomorrow, local Mount Everest climber almost reached the top. A discussion with Metro Parks Director John O'Meara. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon.
Support for 89.7 comes from Picnic with the Pops, presenting Idina Menzel. The Broadway singer and actress on the TV series Glee will perform with the Columbus Symphony Saturday, June 23rd at their new location, the Columbus Commons. Tickets at picnicwiththepops.com.
Wednesday night on WOSU-TV, NOVA follows the development of the telescope over several centuries and examines the use of the telescope to help us understand the Milky Way. Watch NOVA, Hunting the Edge of Space. It's Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV. 85 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine, a high of 92 today. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Verizon announced a new data-only billing plan last week that promises to overhaul the way that Verizon and possibly the rest of the wireless industry handles service payments. Joining us to talk about the changes as well as the latest and greatest service plans and smartphones is Mike Gikas. He has been an editor at Consumer Reports since 2004. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Glad to be with you, Ann.
So Verizon's new data-only billing system, it's
right.
Controversial. Tell us why. Tell us about it first and tell us why it matters.
Well, on the surface, it sounds like, well, great, they're simplifying the plan. You know, everyone uses data, and it takes a lot of the complexity out of choosing a plan under the old plans and on many other carriers' plans. You know, picking up, especially if you have more than one, you're buying for a family, let's say, and multiple phones. They had all these tiers you had from which you had to choose, and so far they're saying, we'll make it simple. We'll charge you so much per phone, whatever kind you have, and here are the different buckets of data you'll use. And we'll give you unlimited voice and texting, let's say, and charge for the data. The trouble with that is if you do the math with some of them, it almost certainly is going to mean that a lot of people are going to be paying at the very least a little more per month, and mostly it'll be single people who are moderate data users, and certainly people who have been, let's say, a longtime Verizon customers but have a relatively basic phone. Let's say I just have a flip phone from the turn of the century, let's say, and this century, not so much.
Yeah.
What it also points to is eventually all phone, everything data, eventually all voice calls are going to be made over data, even from the carrier. You've been hearing a lot about 4G networks, these fast, high-speed data networks. For Verizon and other carriers, that's an opportunity for them to put all of the information that people, all the communication on that people do on a phone, whether it's voice or texting and all that, on their digital data plan, which isn't possible right now with 3G and the early 4G adaptations. Voice and data travel on different paths, and so they're all going to put it all in one. Now, people already use data, speak over data lines. You've heard Skype and so forth. That's you're really using the internet to place the voice call. You're not using the cell carrier's voice network for that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, well, we want part of that too.
Well, so, okay, go on.
And the other thing is smartphones. Most people are you know, they love the apps, and more than half of the phones sold now are smartphones, which you know, are great. They surf the web. You get email. You can stream video and music and all of these things. All of these things. That's all data. And they're getting better and faster. But that also means that they're using more data because they're so good and so fast. And this is an opportunity, I guess, for the carriers to make money, you know, where that growth is.
So I have a smartphone. I use it a lot. I use a lot of, you know, for all the reasons you just mentioned. Am I going to be paying more?
If you're one person on Verizon, if you're one person and you're a moderate user, let's say, mm-hmm. you're probably going to go from paying $90 a month, excluding, you know, the taxes and so mm-hmm. forth, to $100 a month taxes. And Verizon has a calculator, you know, to help people with the transition, either first time customers who will just only have this share everything plan, as they call it,
mm-hmm.
or legacy people who are upgrading, you know, people who've been with them for a while. And the people who could probably really get clobbered are, again, the flip phone users who, because I think if you look at the raw rates, I think they charge you $30 for having a phone and $50 for the baseline everything plan, which is $80. Now, if you use their calculator, they recommend that you go to their pay-as-you-go plan. But that's saying that, look, we don't want you as, like, the regular monthly customer. You just go to our pay-as-you-go plan, which is, like, $40 a month. But if you're at that point, consumers would be better off going to another carrier.
Well, eventually, are all carriers going to go this route, though? Is that the expectation?
It's hard to say. Recently, there was a big trade show in the CTIA in New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
and I spoke with a number of the people who measure data usage, and they sell this information or they sell their services to carriers, and one of them said that things may actually get more complex, not as simple as Verizon is presenting them here. And well, again, what they were thinking of doing is coming up with their own little applications to help you wade through all the various combinations. But the world they described was even more complex than it is now. For example, users asking people to choose plans. Well, if you're a heavy Facebook user but you don't send many texts and you only speak for so much, here's the plan for you, and have, like, I don't know, 12 different items to choose from in terms of a plan or a thing. And then this app would constantly check your monthly usage and recommend what you'd switch to, which sounds crazy. But so, I mean, that might be a future too. But the bottom line is that it clearly indicates there's a shift in the way phones are being used, and the carriers are making those changes to reflect those changes. If you go back 15 years, when the dawn of cell phones for the masses in the mid-90s, if you recall, the most precious thing on a phone were voice minutes, and you paid through the nose. It was like, I think, 30 for 30 minutes of talk. Imagine 30 minutes of talk. You had to pay like $50 a month. And if you went over, you know, the bill would climb astronomically. Now, I mean, even before the switch, people are getting, for $40 a month, they're getting 400 minutes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So and no one's using them. But as they're giving you more minutes, study after study shows people are spending less time talking and more time downloading apps,
texting.
Sending emails, texting,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. You know, the voice now has become a secondary, in some cases tertiary, feature for most users. And it's, you can even tell when you're looking at the phone operating system. I've been testing phones now for since 2004 here, and I can tell you that the phone feature, especially on Android phones, is sometimes getting harder and harder to access. It's almost just like the phone button is just another button in a sea of other things you can do, you know, the messaging button and the calendar button and the Netflix button, and depend whether you're on an iPhone or an Android phone and or any other platform. So it's clear, and no one seems to be complaining about that. And also voice quality in our test hasn't improved one inch, one bit since we've been testing it.
My guest is Mike Gikas. He's senior editor with Consumer Reports. We're talking about Verizon's new data-only billing plan and what's ahead for wireless users and carriers. Give us a call if you have a question about that plan, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to the Facebook page, or you can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. So what about consumers like of other wireless carriers? That's the question, is whether the whole industry is going to head that way.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see. It depends. If you're an underdog, you're probably going to and you want to further differentiate yourself, you'll probably try to hold on to the plans you have now. For example, Sprint so far still has a pretty good deal for heavy data users. They have their Simply Everything plan, but they really throw a lot in for under $100 for unlimited uses. And we found for moderate, for conventional cell phone users and moderate users of smartphones, they're better off with some of the smaller carriers, T-Mobile, for example, and also the kinds of plans. Instead of going with a contract, they may find better deals by going with prepaid. And sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just wondering about people who are in the middle of a contract. Will they have to switch immediately? How's that going to work? Or can they play out the rest of their plan until the, you know, until
the people will be grandfathered in. And I believe, I don't know, eventually they'll be forced off, but they do have time. So if you're in the middle of your contract now, I don't think it'll affect you or for most of the plan. But new customers certainly will only have this plan from which to choose, and but there are other carriers that don't have it. It was hinted that AT&T, I think, hinted that they might be going that way. But again, there are other carriers out there too. I mean, people think of the big four, but one of the smaller regional carriers, Consumer Cellular, was tops in our annual survey last year, and. And they earned high scores for value and customer service, certainly. And two areas where Verizon didn't do well. They're known for having a great network and people flock to them, but they're not really great for when you have a problem you want to get it resolved. Mm-hmm. And they certainly people don't feel they're getting a great deal. I mean, they run to the network for its reliability. I mean, there's a lot to like about Verizon, but they don't think they're getting it for a steal. And we'll see what kind of impact that's going to have next year when in our next year service results come out in January. But they traditionally were a high-rated carrier, certainly among the big four in most of the markets between the 20 and 25 markets we survey every year. This is certainly going to, I suspect, some people are going to burn, and other people are, if they might actually save a little money. People with multiple, you know, a lot of phones that are moderate users may actually save a buck or two. There are a lot of little combinations, and again, you have to use the Verizon's calculator to figure out what your monthly bill will be, especially if you have a mix of phones. If you have, if you're throwing into the mix not just phones, but laptops with cards in them for accessing the data network, mm-hmm. or plain phones or tablets. So there are all sorts of different rates and different combos, and you just have this big, you know, pot that the family splits, and you can upgrade that pot for a certain amount of money. But what's true now and what's true then is you can always there are penalties for going over your allowance, but the carriers, for the most part, allow you to switch so that you don't pay the overage rate. You know, so if you find yourself using more data, for example, if you were using under the current plan, if you're using 2 gigabytes a month, but one month you end up using 2.5 gigabytes of data, first of all, you'll probably get a warning from the carrier via text message on your phone. And two, they usually let you change, and you can change back as you, I don't know what the limit is, but without penalty, you can upgrade to a higher data allowance for, say, $10 a month or something.
Paul and Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. One thing I wanted to point out and confirm this with the guest, the cost per gigabyte on mobile devices and this Verizon plan is really pretty outrageous if you look at it. It's like $10 a gigabyte. And, you know, compare that to like UVerse. I have UVerse at home, which is pretty good, with a 250 gigabyte limit. It's supposed to be unlimited, but then they changed that. But even if you used all 250 gigabytes, I mean, compared to what that would cost on Verizon, would be like $2,500 a month if you got anywhere near close to that. And what about using another carrier like T-Mobile or Sprint or something? I realize their networks aren't so great, but so extensive as Verizon. But if you're in a decent area there, they could be a good way to save, wouldn't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. There, again, Verizon's regarded as a Cadillac service, and you're paying a premium, and they may be your only choice in some areas because they do have considerable coverage and a reputation for network reliability. But Sprint has really climbed up from the cellar in recent years. They used to be have a horrible reputation across the board for, you know, everything, not only just coverage, but if you had a problem, you'd really find yourself up against the wall. No, actually, Sprint, especially if you're a heavy data user, is certainly going to be a much better deal if you have the coverage. They have very narrow, they're certainly in most of the big cities, but you may find you have difficulty if you're going out a little bit out of into the outer burbs. Ditto for Walmart. I'm sorry, for T-Mobile, which also brands its services under Walmart. I think it's Walmart Family Phone or something, and they're very good. You can really get some great deals. And if you're in an area where T-Mobile coverage is reasonable, you'll be happier.
Thank you, Paul. Have a good day. And thanks to you, Mike Gikas.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate you joining us today. Mike Gikas, he's a senior editor for Consumer Reports. I want to thank everybody for listening as well. You can listen back to today's shows and every show by visiting WOSU.org/AllSides. Explore the All Sides archive where you can find more information, links and audio and video of every show. Also, be sure to like All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at AnnFisherWOSU. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurevich, All Sides intern Corinne Gleckler, All Sides volunteers Rachel Ramey and Andrew Sweet, with video production by Rich and Amber Karsmiski. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.